Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi.
How'd you know it was me?
Same caller ID.
Oh, what's it say?
Linda Tripp.
It does? I have an unpublished phone, the idiot.
The great story here is this vast right-wing conspiracy that has been conspiring against my husband since the day he announced for president.
May of 91, Bill Clinton harassed me on the job and then basically told me, let's keep this between ourselves.
You had no sexual relationship with this young woman.
There is not a sexual relationship. That is accurate.
Hello and welcome to episode one of Still Watching, American Crime Story, Impeachment. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I am Vanity Fair's awards and audio editor Katie Rich.
Richard has found himself stranded in the mountains. No, he's off at Telluride. So Katie and I are helming the ship this week, which is, I think, is suitable for this opening episode, which really introduces us to a lot of fascinating women. So here it is. Go ahead.
It's nice of you to say that Richard's at Telluride, but in fact, he's just checked into the Watergate to try to get the full Monica Lewinsky experience.
It's true. He's digging through the trash at Watergate to sort of find out what's going on. No. Ladies' night here on Still Watching. If you are just joining us for the first time, what we do in this show is we break down a season of television that we are sort of obsessively watching. Right now, we are obsessively into American Crime Story, Impeachment. You can listen to our preview episode, which we dropped last week, where we talked to showrunner Sarah Burgess. If you want to hear her thoughts on things. This week, our colleague Chris Murphy talked to the great Annalee Ashford, who plays Paula Jones. So you will hear that towards the end of the episode. We will throw to that interview. But this is our introduction to some key players. So we're going to talk about Paula. We're going to talk about Linda. We're obviously going to talk about Monica. And also, we want to hear from all of you. So if you want to email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, that's where you can find us. We asked for some prompts last week. We're not going to get to them this week because we're recording this a little early. So you haven't had a chance to email us yet.
Sending us your prompts in the future.
Yeah, soon we will be able to read all of your emails, and we're excited for this to be sort of an interactive show.
I'm excited to hear from people once they've seen episode one, too. Like, I think the preview episode, we got into a lot of the themes of the show, but I do think there's a real value in, like, seeing it for yourself.
Of course. Yeah, totally. And I want to hear from folks what their experience was of this whole thing. How old were you? Depending on how old you were at the time, what is your memory of it? If you weren't even born at the time, which is technically possible, of course it is, you know, what is your idea of it as a historical event sort of thing? So I'd love to hear from folks on that. But we're going to start at the very beginning of this episode, a very good place to start, on a night, January 13, 1998, known as Prom Night, because that was the name of the operation, for gross reasons that we'll get into. Mm-hmm. But this is where it all starts. Katie, what do you think of this? We then zoom back to 93, 94, et cetera. But what do you think of the show starting with January 13, 1998?
I mean, it's like a TV cliche at this point, right? Where you like start with like some dramatic moment and then it's like, you know, the record scratch, how did I get here? and, you know, they're doing it a little bit more elegantly than that. And I do think the like, you start with the betrayal, like, because you go into a show called Impeachment, like it can be about Bill Clinton, it could be about Ken Starr, it could be about Ann Coulter, like, you know, and all these people play roles in it. But to start with Linda and Monica, like to get into the meat of the story from the very beginning, I think is really useful for framing what to expect from it. And you go through this whole process of her being brought into this hotel room, and it ends right before it cuts the title on, I want that treacherous bitch to see what she's done to me. And I was so stunned by that. And I think the version of Monica that we see in the episode is really not that person, but that's a real line. She really said that, as I learned on Slow Burn, which is incredible.
Yeah, I think Monica herself put that in her book or so, you know, like this is Monica's recollection of what she said. Cause it's one of those moments. This is something I talked to Sarah about last week. Like there are lines that you will hear in the show where you're like, well, that's a little over the top. And then you'll find out almost every single case, you'll find out that that's actually something that was said, at least according to the recollection of the people who were there, or it's captured on tape. So
yeah,
it's what a line.
A lot of this is captured on tape. Yes, we learn.
What a line to go out on. So
I've also had It's a Beautiful Life. Is that Ace of Base? The song that she's doing, that Monica's doing her step aerobics to? Like, it's been stuck in my head ever since I watched this episode.
Well, something that I really love about this opening, too, is we've got Monica. She's packing up to leave for New York, which is what Monica had been planning to do mm-hmm. here in January 1998. And you have her say goodbye to her barista at Starbucks, et cetera. And it just, you get this sense of someone who almost made it out mm-hmm. of all of this without her entire world being upended. She's like, you know, one last job sort of thing.
Yeah.
One last lunch with Linda Tripp, and then it all came crashing down. So.
Yeah. I mean, she was already in so deep. Like, you know, the fact that the job she was leaving for was set up by Vernon Jordan, who was working for Clinton. Like, she was so entangled, she was never actually going to get out. But you do get that optimistic sense. Yeah. She's like packing up her apartment. She's like, got the newspaper from when Clinton got reelected. And you're like, maybe she won't take it with her. Maybe she'll really move on. And then it all came back around to her.
The Leaves of Grass was like, I was just talking to someone a couple of weeks ago about the fact that, and this person had not seen the show, but we were talking about Bill Clinton, and he was talking about how Clinton gave Monica, this is a present that Clinton gave Monica, famously, a copy of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, and how that is like one of the smoothest like gifts you could give a mistress. It's like, here's a volume of a beautifully bound volume of poetry.
It's the same book he gave to Hillary when they were dating, isn't it?
I mean, the man has a move. He has one move, it works.
That really grosses me out. Like, yeah. There's a lot of gross behavior in this story, but come on, have some respect for Hillary.
It's tough. And then we briefly see in this opening montage, we briefly see another familiar face who we won't see again for a little while in the show, which is Mike Amick, who's played by Colin Hanks. And I talked to Sarah last week in the preview episode about Mike Amick because he's one of the most fascinating to me figures in all this, because there is so little about him that exists. Because as soon as, you know, the thing, I don't know if you have this experience when you watch these shows, but when someone crops up... I know you do, because I was like, oh, wow, Taron Killam's here playing Paula Jones' husband. And you immediately shot me back a photo of Paula Jones' actual husband. And be like, wow, that's good casting.
Yeah.
Like, you immediately want to go and see what the real person looked like to see if the casting looks wise, let alone, you know, sort of feelings wise makes sense. And so I immediately went to look for a photo of Mike Amick when I saw Colin Hanks is here. There's literally like one that exists on the internet.
Wow.
And it's sort of like this weird candid with a filing cabinet behind him. And there's so little information, because unlike so many people involved in this, he is not someone who wanted to talk about this for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And so there's so little from him. And then he passed away kind of recently. And so it's just like he remains this really, which I think is an interesting challenge for Sarah as she's writing him, of all the figures in this story, maybe the most sort of impenetrable. Does that make sense?
Yeah. When he was one of the ones who like didn't seem crazy about how it all shook out, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot. When you hear from these folks talk about what happened, especially on that January 13, 1998 night, there's a lot of regret. Lot of regret, it seems like. So, so we will return to 1998 eventually down the road.
Well, when you said that there was a familiar face, I thought you were going to say Leonardo DiCaprio on the cover of Vanity Fair on the newsstand that Monica goes to in the mall, which is a cover I know very well.
I didn't clock that, but I love that you clocked that.
Oh, yeah. No, she buys a different magazine, but I definitely saw Leonardo's masterpiece cover story on there. Because January 98, Leonardo DiCaprio was like, was the biggest person in the country until, I guess, Monica became the biggest person in the country.
Something that you and I had talked about that we didn't really maybe realize until we were a few more episodes into the series is how Monica comes from a lot of money. Rewatching it, knowing that she drives a very fancy car. That's an early signal. And also costume wise, we're going to talk about this a little bit more when we get to Paula Jones, but there are photos of Monica and Linda where Monica is wearing that exact like fleece, leggings, scrunchy ponytail combo. Like that's an exact outfit. So that's sort of the vibe we're going for. If we can get the exact outfit, we're going for the exact outfit sort of thing. So
yeah,
there you go.
Yep.
So we're going to, the show itself then goes to Linda, and we will obviously be talking a lot about Linda Tripp, but I wanted to actually talk about Paula Jones first. And this is a, you know, we've talked about this before, in the preview episode, but something that, Ryan Murphy has said, there's a whole New York Times article about this, is this idea of presenting this story through the lens of the women. And the four major women in this story are Monica Lewinsky, Linda Tripp, Paula Jones, and Hillary Clinton. Of those four women, I feel like I knew Paula Jones the least. What was your like knowledge of Paula Jones before this series, watching the episode?
Yeah, I virtually nothing. Like I knew, you know, the basics that she had sued Clinton and that she was kind of like a tabloid target. Maybe not as extremely as Monica was, but to that extent, she was from Arkansas. I definitely didn't know what her voice was like. And as a Southerner, I always like when anyone's doing a Southern accent, I'm always like, okay, all right, let's see if this is real. And then Googled Paula Jones. And as we'll discuss, like she sounded exactly like Annalee Ashford, like to a crazy degree. And I definitely remember like the big hair and the makeup and everything. And they get into kind of her personal look in the show. But yeah, I think same as you, like she was a much more obscure figure than the other ones.
She, you know, much has been made about Linda Tripp's, like the prosthetics and padding that Sarah Paulson's wearing as Linda Tripp. But there's a number of prosthetics throughout the show. We'll get to Clive Owen as Bill Clinton, but the nose here is a prosthetic on the tip of her nose on Annalee Ashford. And, you know, Paula Jones sort of famously got a nose job over the course of this whole thing. And it's part of the story. So, How are these lighter prosthetics working for you, Katie?
Oh, I Googled Annalee Ashford. I was like, I'm really bad at noticing like noses in plastic surgery. So I was like, is that a fake nose? So extremely well. And like, obviously there's a lot of hair. Like I certainly realized that was a wig and I think that looks great too. It's really, she's really lived in character and really not caricatured, which I think is really part of the mission of the show is to make these people exist as fully fledged human beings.
Annalee Ashford is someone that Richard and I talked about a lot in American Crime Story Versace. She played like a pretty peripheral character in that show, but she was incredible in that role. She's more of a stage actress, I think, than she is a TV and film actress, though she's been in a number of things. But she's just someone that I think is just underrated, incredible, and I think she's really, really good in this role. The amount of like deer in a headlights vibe that she gives to Paula Jones. This there's a spine to her. There's the determination, but there's also a sense of a woman who is just swept up in something so much bigger than herself. There's pride and just complete fear and vulnerability, all of that together.
Well, I think it sets up so well that, like, none of this might have happened if that article in The American Spectator, which is about Troopergate, which, like, I feel like you've done the deep dive on Troopergate. Maybe you can explain it better to the rest of us. But it claimed that she had, like, volunteered herself to be, like, one of Clinton's girlfriends. And, like, she was so adamant that that never happened, that this was an unwanted sexual advance. And if they hadn't said that, maybe she never would have sued and none of this would have happened.
I know. It's one of those dominoes, right? So, yeah, mm-hmm. David Brock, who's a journalist who wrote this article, His Cheating Heart, I think, is the title of it in the American Spectator. And Troopergate is this sort of scandal about when he was governor, when Clinton was governor in Arkansas, and these troopers were used, state troopers were used to coerce women to, like, come and, you know, give sexual favors to Bill Clinton, or be sexually assaulted by Bill Clinton.
Or to just, like, invite them up. Like, it's unclear if there was, like, how much coercion when there was happening, but, like, you get the sense that there were plenty of women who would happily go do that. Paula Jones was just
So that's the framing in the article, right? But what subsequently came to light, so David Brock, who wrote the article, and was famous before that article for writing an article called The Real Anita Hill, challenging the claims of Anita Hill, had a change of heart, or a change of allegiance at least, and switch sides. It's weird to talk about these things as sides, but the way that Brock describes it is that he discovered that the troopers in his story, among other things, that the troopers in his story had been paid by enemies of the Clintons. That's what he alleges, and a number of other things. And so he wrote a book later called Blinded by the Right in 2002, and just became, like, a real Clinton acolyte later. But he was, you know, one of the gleeful, punctures of the Clinton legacy earlier in his career. And so Troopergate is really interesting because there's not much there. I think about it journalistically. You, Katie, as my editor, would never have let me, write or print Troopergate, I think.
Oh, yeah.
There's not enough evidence there. And especially, you would not let me put the first name of one, because they just put Paula in the article, not Paula Jones. You would not let me put the first name of a woman in an article without talking to her, like, way yeah. more. Like, all of this stuff is hugely journalistically, ethically, sloppy is the kindest, way that I could say it. But it is a major domino in all of this, in that mm-hmm. it sweeps Paula Jones up because everyone in her circle knows that that's her, and yeah. sweeps her up in all of this. And then we should also talk about the figure of her husband. What is your read on this guy?
I was just going to say, because you see her, she's got the magazine. She's, like, living in Long Beach, and he's trying to make it as an actor. And he comes home and he does this kind of, like, typical macho thing of, like, everyone's going to know that my wife was in a hotel room with Bill Clinton. And you're like, all right, buddy, like, this isn't really about you. But he's also kind of a pitiful figure. Like, he's not this easy villain, which I don't think the show really needs him to be. And, like, Ed Harron Killam is really, like, well cast and, like, does a really good job. Again, another good Southern accent. So I think, like, he and Paula are just kind of trying to, like, scramble for whatever they can get in this world. Like, he's not doing that well as an actor. And you feel bad for him, and more bad for her, but I felt bad for him too.
I feel bad for him, but at the same time, when I found out that, like, they got divorced shortly thereafter, I'm just sort of like, because I feel bad for him, and I feel very bad for her, and there is this implication, at least in how it's scripted here, that his wounded pride is a big part of what pushes her into yes. this lawsuit, right?
Yeah, that she suffered immensely because of his wounded pride.
Right. And, like, not to say she shouldn't have pursued the apology and recompense and all that sort of thing on her own, but I just, you know, it's just another force sort of buffeting this woman in one direction or another. And,
And he wants a role in Designing Women because the Clintons are friends with the creators. And I just read on his line, a love interest for Delta Burke. Maybe they can bring me back if the chemistry's good.
Yeah.
Like, he knows how to speak the lingo.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Linda this is not the last of the Designing Women verse that will show up in this.
Oh my god.
There was also
that great
line, not to get too distracted, but there's this great line in Linda's storyline about you'll be seated next to Estelle Parsons from the Roseanne show. I mean, it's just like,
so there'll be two VIPs.
Estelle Parsons, incredible stuff. But yeah, Linda Bloodworth Thomason and her husband, who co-created Designing Women, were great friends of the Clintons, and I think like somehow worked around the Clinton. I mean, they definitely heavily campaigned for her, and it's the reason why I knew who Clinton was before he was president, because they would mention him as the governor of Arkansas on the show because they were from.
Wow,
Arkansas. Yeah,
that's good memory.
They would talk. Well, I rewatched Designing Women sometimes. They would talk about him as governor of Arkansas, and then there's a whole episode about the characters on Designing Women, and if you've never watched Designing Women, but you love the actress Jean Smart, that is her origin story. Go watch Designing Women.
Yeah.
It's all on Hulu. Mm-hmm. That there's a whole episode about the characters from Designing Women going to the Clinton inauguration and getting stuck in an airport trying to get to the Clinton inauguration, the whole thing. So So, okay, but let's get back to the Joneses, which is then they go to CPAC, which is this thing that did happen. CPAC is not a thing that I was aware of until the Trump presidency is when I became aware of what CPAC was. But it's, you know, it's this massive conservative gathering. I don't know what it was then, but it's given what they show us, seems like it's similar to what it is now, which is it's like a friendly home for sort of fringe frothing aspects of the conservative wing of government, and because you see all this merch that's like impeach the bitch of Hillary Clinton. There's another one with like Bill that's essentially lock him. It's like a real lock her up vibe.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think the idea is that that used to be more fringe to CPAC, and it has become more and more central to the whole thing. And you see with this whole like Trooper Gate, Paula Jones press conference that's centering on, like, the turnout's not huge. Like, it was not the main event at that point. So maybe the great minds of the conservative movement really were speaking back then, and it's changed since then.
But yeah, that this was considered like a real rinky-dink, a real like failure because of, you know, they were trying to be very delicate and restrained and not, I think it was like not dishonor the office of the president by getting too graphic in details, et cetera. But a lot of the stuff that you hear from Paula here is word for word and intonation for intonation what that press conference was like.
Yeah. The way you say it's like, I won't speak on that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Oh, you feel so bad for her.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing is going to be an indictment of the media, but the journalists in that scene, you're just like, Jesus.
Now, are the journalists, like, did you see the journalists in that moment? Like, they felt a little inflated to me.
They did.
The Pack of Jackals vibe there.
I have heard audio from it, and then I looked it up on YouTube today, and all I could see were clips of her speaking.
Yeah.
So I did not hear the journalists, and I had the same reaction you did, where they just felt, like, a little too jackally, to be
real.
Yeah,
you can imagine them being annoyed and, like, saying afterward how ridiculous it was. But, like, the extent to which they are so cruel to her face felt a little much.
But, you know.
Not that the media really executes itself very well over the course of this series.
Again and again, I'm surprised what's ripped directly from what happened. So I will try to see if I can hunt down what those journalists sounded like. But this is not a successful moment, but she's pushed up here once again by, like, all of this is being pushed along by people who have a vested interest in taking down Clinton, right? So that's just clear, because Ann Coulter and a couple of these folks, these powerful conservative DC folks, Jerome Marcus and Richard Porter, are two big figures that we won't see a lot of because they haven't remained sort of famous people. But George Conway, Kellyanne Conway's husband, and Ann Coulter, who is Ann Coulter, who remain, you know, very public figures, were part of this team that was pushing behind the scenes to get this Paula Jones thing going. And the idea was, and Kobe Smulders delivers it perfectly as Ann Coulter, this idea of, like, if we push it to a case where Bill Clinton has to testify, he will lie. And in lying, we could get him on perjury. And that's the whole idea. I love the delivery of, you know, he's Bill Clinton, he'll lie.
Like, I mean, it's one of several moments, and I think more of them come later, where Ann Coulter says something, you're like, I mean, she's right. Yeah. Like, okay. And she's so obnoxious, but so you get why she became famous, because she's funny, even though she's awful, you know? Toby Smulders is really good at that.
She's really good. That's the thing about Ann Coulter is, like, you never like to agree with her. and you never like to find her witty or amusing, but sometimes she's witty and amusing, and it's uncomfortable.
Worst person you know just made a great point. Exactly. Onion gets it right every time.
Exactly. But so they push her beyond this sort of local Arkansas lawyer to, you know, to get her case taken up by, and apparently a number of sort of higher power lawyers were chomping at the bit to take the Paula Jones case. But, Davis and Camerata are the two lawyers who end up taking your case. And they are, once again, aided by these behind the scenes. And they're being billed for their help from these behind the scenes folks who are doing a lot of research, high level research, onto how to turn this Paula Jones complaint into a huge problem for the Clintons. So that's all there is. I mean, the last thing I'll say about Paula Jones, once again, I think Emily Ashford's great, but it's an interesting thing that the show has decided to not get extremely sexually explicit in what it shows. That was mm-hmm. a decision that they made. But then you have these moments like Paula Jones drawing Bill Clinton's penis. You know what I mean? And you cannot be genteel in a story like this. And that's part of the reason why we were all so captivated is... Uh-huh. An uncomfortable word, but that's the word, because it's so seedy. Every aspect of it is seedy. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah. I still struggle to realize what her drawing it, what good it did. It's not like she's a courtroom sketch artist. Like, I don't know. This may be too explicit for this podcast, especially, but she did it and it's part of the historical record. So I guess someone found it useful.
I mean, the line, "It takes a dramatic turn," is.
I know. No, that line is incredible.
So good. So that's the thing, but like, you know, in with all this like seediness and humor is, once again, this is really vulnerable. There's this beautiful shot when they're talking to her about, like, you know, is there anything you don't want to have come out? It'll all come out. It's just a shot of Annalee Ashford in profile, her eyes sort of welling up, and it's just, you know, mm-hmm. it's a really hard to watch moment. There's comedy and scandal, but there's just also immense tragedy hanging over all of this. So,
yep.
All right. So that let's go to Linda. We start with Linda in 1993, and like what's important to note about how we meet Linda here, you know, beyond the morning cigarette and Slim Fast Shake, is the, you know, hushed poshness of the White House and her position there, as it will mm-hmm. contrast to the Pentagon later. What did you think of this introduction?
Oh, she's got such all her little lamps and her printer right next to her. Actually, it just occurred to me that, like, there's a whole drama about the printer when she goes to work at the Pentagon, and she's got one on her desk and it's right there and everything works perfectly. And Vince Foster, who's her boss, who I'm certain we'll get into, like, just seems like a good boss. Like, he seems like a nice, thoughtful person to work for. And she loves it, and you get why she loves it. And I think you get... really early on her sense of being like, I am here doing the most important work in the world. And that is such a huge part of why she makes the choices that she does.
Something I didn't notice until I watched all the way through and then looped back to this first episode is she's smiling in that first scene in a way that we don't ever see her smile again.
Mm.
That this is like Linda in her element, feeling valued and in her element, and happy in a way she'll never, according to, you know, this depiction of her, will never be happy again.
Although you can also see how, like, you know, so you see Edie Falco show up very briefly as Hillary Clinton and say, I think she just says the words hello.
Right.
Because she and Linda Tripp are in the same bathroom. And Linda is, like, so outraged that the first lady would use the bathroom that everyone else doesn't even have an office in the West Wing. But she kind of loves that, too. Like, her whole snobbiness is part of what gives her pleasure, too, of being like, well, I was around when everything was better. And she's got this really willing listener in Kathleen Willey, who becomes a big part of the story in the episode.
In the episode and in the whole thing, I really had forgotten about Kathleen Willey as the elemental of this.
Well, she's such a good counterbalance to Linda that, like, Monica kind of becomes later in the show, like, listening to her being like, okay, Linda, yeah, you're in the eye of a hurricane. Mm-hmm. I didn't look at the actress who plays her, but she's really good.
It's Elizabeth Reeser, yeah.
Right.
Of Twilight fame and other fame. But sorry to put Twilight fame next to Elizabeth Reeser's name. She deserves more.
She's done much good work.
But she's fantastic in that, that like she seems like a somewhat meek person, but is rolling her eyes so hard. But at the same time, like there is something about Linda that these younger women are drawn to her. Do you know what I mean? And there's a way in which she inserts herself, and that's the theme over and over again, is Linda inserting herself into things, right?
Yeah.
Definitely true of like Vince Foster and Whitewater. We hear her say in this episode, like, I know too much, or I'm definitely gonna have to testify, or all this sort of stuff like that, like building up her sense of importance in all these events. But yeah, and we talked about this in the preview episode, but just in case folks didn't listen to this, like, what was your first impression of when you finally saw what Sarah Paulson was doing under all of these, you know, prosthetic additives in this role?
I think it's how quickly it became complex, like how it takes like two scenes for you to get her loving working at the White House, being a snob about the Clintons, wanting to inflate her sense of importance, but also being really good at her job, really liking Vince Foster. Like there's not really a wasted moment, and you get such a complex portrait so quickly. And, you know, we talked in the preview episode about kind of mixed feelings about the prosthetics and the padding and everything, but I don't, like, she's so fully formed so early that you really, I don't know, I have to admire it and get over any hesitation I would have about Sarah Paulson playing the role.
It's teeth and posture almost more than it's like
hair,
you know what I mean? But like the posture is like a huge part of it. It's really interesting. It's a really, since we did the preview episode, you know, critics have released their reviews of the series, not all positive, and a lot of people are not liking this performance. And I'm really into it. Like, I think it's really, it's a big performance, but also doesn't feel to me inhuman. It feels very
Feels like somewhat like someone that you know that you've worked with, like the office busybody, or the person who thinks that everything was done better in the good old days. Like, it's so real to me.
A big part of that is the exasperated way. And some, you know, like we talked about Kathleen Milley, but to zoom ahead just briefly, her cubicle mate in the Pentagon was just like, they're doing electrical work, Linda. Like, oh my God. Linda. Anyway, so good. There's this detail about Vince Foster leaving these M&Ms, which is a true detail that happened. It's such an interesting little detail. I'm so glad it's included, because it's like, it's a gesture of kindness, but it's also like when you see them on the tray, it just looks like scraps. Also,
yeah, it's like, here's my leftovers.
Yeah. It's next so to my weird. Half-eaten burger, and there was a container of them. He could have like put them back in the container and handed. You know, there's just like there was a way to leave them that didn't seem so, I've left you my scraps, Linda.
And you've seen her like sneak the one M&M from the bowl in the White House cafeteria to get it for him. So you get like the weight of M&Ms, like weight, no pun intended, but like the significance of it. Like she is like watching what she. You've seen her have the Slim Fast, and that he would know that. And like you're right, it's like a real combination of a diss and a kind gesture.
Yeah. We see Vince, there's a really interesting moment, where we see Vince hand her a couple of envelopes, early in the day. And I paused my screener to look at what it was.
I did.
So it's Alice Mae Foster, who's his mom, is who it's addressed to. And this is Life Insurance Fund. And then I went Googling to see if like there's an evidentiary trail, because like if Vince Foster sent out some life insurance thing to his mom before he went off to kill himself, like that would be a huge piece of evidence that he did in fact kill himself, which is the whole heart of the quote unquote scandal. I don't like calling it a scandal, conspiracy theory. Thank you. But I could not find that in a good faith effort of Googling, but I will keep looking to see if that is something I could find.
I wonder if that was just to be like, hey, this is Vince Foster. Like, you see the name Foster on the envelope just to like really ping that in your brain.
Maybe. But it just like the life insurance part of the.
Yeah, that is weird.
I was like, what's going on? So, you know, if you're at home and you know more about this than I do,
please don't get too deep on a Reddit thread about this.
Don't do that.
Will start tracking your phone.
Don't do that. But go ahead and email us if you know more than I do, which you probably do. But there's also the light implications of the rumor that Vince Foster and Hillary Clinton were having an affair, which is like was a rumor at the time and all of that. But so Vince Foster sort of, you know, my belief of the version of events is that Vince Foster, despairing at being entangled again and again in controversy of the Clinton administration, he followed these friends from Arkansas. Travelgate is this whole thing with the travel office that you can look up if you need to, but like being involved again and again and all of that weighed too heavily on him. And, you know, whether he felt like he had let them down or whether he couldn't handle being in controversy at all.
Well, he had a history of depression, so elements unrelated to working in the White House.
Possibly. All of that goes to the woods and kills himself. And this is it's a huge moment that people still talk about all the time associated with the Clintons, this conspiracy theory that they had Vince Foster killed. But for the purposes of this story, it's an inciting incident of Linda getting booted from the White House. Right.
I do have, I think this first episode is really strong. I think it maybe lingers on Vince Foster's suicide a little too long. Like, you don't want to, like, blow past a really awful moment in someone's life. And it was a really awful moment for Linda. But it does, like, I think if you've tuned in, you've seen the cold open with Monica and Linda, you kind of get the Remember Impeachment. You're like, wait, why are we lingering on Vince Foster in the woods in his car? I don't know. I'm sure they had good reason for it, but that's like kind of the one misstep in this episode for me.
I think, I don't wholly disagree with you, but I think a big part of it is, or a part of it seems to me to be at least like, yes, he definitely killed himself. Like, this is the stance the show is taking, sure. Right?
Yeah. No ambiguity about it.
Right, exactly. Before Linda leaves the White House, we get a little bit more of Bernie Nussbaum, played by Kevin Pollak. He is vehemently against this idea of hiring an independent counsel. And we get a brief cameo from George Stephanopoulos, the young George Stephanopoulos, who's advocating for it. And to this day, Bernie Nussbaum is like, I told them hiring Ken Starr was a mistake.
I mean, can you imagine like having been so like historically on the right side of history and no one listened to you? Like, I'd never stop talking about it either.
He's like, I really told them that Ken Starr was a mistake. I promise.
Let the record show.
Yeah. George Stephanopoulos is handsome and wrong, and I was right. So there you go. And like sort of the last element of this Linda in the White House era before she tragically fails a job interview. Doing that thing you're not supposed to do, which is shit talk your current job.
Yeah,
don't
man.
Do that. It makes you seem like a really bad employee. She meets with a literary agent, Lucianne Goldberg, played by Margot Martindale. And at that point, Lucianne is sort of trying to get her to give her whatever, you know, dirty goss she can get on Clinton. It seems like, and this is something that Lucianne Goldberg herself, if you've ever seen her interviewed, incredible, swathed in velvet often, will talk about, you know, she was out there trying to get book deals for anyone who was anti-Clinton. Like, that was her whole thing.
So. What an incredible character she is. And like, you Google her and you're like, that, oh yeah, that's exactly what she looked like. Margot Martindale is flawless casting for her. Like, she sits there, she has her phone, like an old fashioned, like white and chrome phone that she like picks up on. She's wearing like feathers. And she's so funny. Like, you see her, she's like on the phone while she's waiting to meet with Linda, and she talks about how Lady Bird Johnson pushed her down a flight of stairs at a party. It's just so funny. Like, and in some ways, like Ann Coulter, where it's just like, you are standing for a lot of despicable things, but like, I get why you're good in a room.
Yeah, exactly. She's a magnetic figure. And sorry, I said last thing, but obviously, like, this incident with Kathleen Willey coming out of the Oval, flustered, lipstick smeared. Yeah. Asking for help from Linda, and then Linda, you know, absorbing that information the way that she does, not terribly helpful and comforting, but absorbing it. And then later, when Kathleen Willey gets, you know, has a job and Linda doesn't, doing a very dramatic shaking finger in the face, I'm gonna get you for this moment. But that's all part of the stew, and basically the investigation that the show is running, which is, why did Linda Tripp do what she did, right?
Yeah. I wanted to say about that disaster shop interview they had, that like, Linda is really obnoxious in that interview. Like, she's like, Well, as you know, I'm sure you know Toni Snow, and like I get why they didn't like her, but like if a man did that, like I don't think it would go over the same way. Like I don't know if that's part of what the show is saying, but I do think Linda's like power, you know, puffing out her chest vibe is something that a lot of men do and that's get true. Away with, and Linda didn't.
That's true. And there's also just this exploration of like what is, once again, like the word genteel, like there's something about Lloyd Cutler is the person taking over Bernie Nussbaum, his assistant in that scene, and how she's like refined, and like Kathleen Willey fits her mold of refined and Linda Tripp doesn't. You know what I mean? There's just this sort of like you don't fit, in the same way that I feel like if the Clintons weren't from Arkansas, I mean, Bill is, Hillary isn't, but like if Bill wasn't from Arkansas, there's this whole aura of like Arkansas trash. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That lingers around the Clintons that allows their opponents, which I don't agree with, I should make clear, but like which allows their opponents to take it to a tabloid level, I think, really quickly. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I know as a Southerner, you're not going to let me get away with any Southern slander. I'm not slandering myself. But
I mean, Lucianne Goldberg says there's a Kmart spirit in the air.
That's right. That's right.
Although that's talking about the Clinton haters, I guess, not the Clinton people. But yeah, it's definitely go hand in hand.
Yeah. All right. So let's. And I was reminded, I wrote this in the notes, please, everyone listening at home, feel free to roll your eyes at my obligatory Game of Thrones reference. But I was just thinking about, Littlefinger, and I was thinking about Linda. And like this idea of like someone who's like, I'm not being given what I'm owed. And the motivation being like, I have been slighted and I deserve more. And I'm going to manipulate things behind the scenes to ensure that people have slighted me fall and that I rise as a result. Mm-hmm. That's not my complete portrait of Linda, but it's definitely a flavor of Linda. So, I mean,
it's definitely something that like puts her, she's not exactly the like Clinton haters who were percolating around the time, but she is such an easy ally for them for that reason.
Yeah. So then we go to the Pentagon and, you know, once again, we get that contrast as Linda walks into the Pentagon and then we get the introduction of Monica and Monica meeting Linda. And, once again, I just have to like think about like what we have this moment where Monica sees this Bill Clinton poster in this office that Linda's occupying, and it's not Linda's poster, but that's what immediately draws her eye. But that's not the only reason. They're bonded by their loneliness. We see them each eating dinner by themselves a little later in the episode. So they are the incredibly lonely, both kicked out of the White House women who form this bond. Linda, perhaps immediately in a usury way, we're not sure. But Monica sees something in Linda that perhaps Kathleen Willey did once upon a time that makes her seem like a place to go in all of this. What do you think of that?
And Monica already being like, she's kind of too loose-lipped from the very beginning where it's like, you know, why'd you leave the White House? She's like, well, it wasn't exactly my choice. Like, she's 24. Like, you can tell she's just kind of eager to talk about her feelings in a way, and she's been hiding it. Although, I think as the show emerges, like, she definitely didn't keep the whole thing a secret as much as she probably should have. But you see why, like, Linda being right there would be so appealing to her. I love that moment where Monica sees the Bill Clinton poster in the office, and she thinks it's Linda's office, and Linda just says, there are fumes in my cubicle. And it's such a good Linda Tripp line. The whole thing about the fumes is really funny. And the fact that they bond over talking about Weight Watchers meals in the cafeteria, and like the food and the body image culture, like it becomes maybe more of a topic we can talk about in future episodes. But like, it's just like if you were there, you know, and you know why they'd be talking about Weight Watchers frozen meals in the cafeteria, which is so sad, but so correct for who we know of these women to have been at the time.
This is something that Sarah, in our interview with her in the preview episode, talked about at length that I thought was really interesting. This idea of like Monica and Linda as these women who felt invisible in some aspects. And of course, like the way in which that would mean the attention from Bill Clinton for Monica is, you know, just, I mean, how irresistible, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Monica. Go ahead.
Also, shout out to the production design of the office of the Pentagon. I was thinking about the office in Loki, I can't remember what it was called, but like,
the
you know,
TVA,
kind of this like grim, modern, like you know, brutal office space, and the Pentagon is just like so much worse. Like, what an awful, awful workplace it looks like.
Yeah. Just and drab. Awful.
Yeah, they're all kind of dressed like the cubicles too, like all the like browns and grays of the late 90s like match the vibe. It's just like, you know, when Monica's like, or Linus is like, no one wants to be here, like, oh yeah, no one wants to be here.
Wants to be here. and you are reminded of how young Monica is. She's 23, about to turn 23. I mean, wild.
So young.
Wild. So that's it. That's episode one.
Well, no, you skipped the reveal at the very end of the episode.
Oh, yeah. Who Monica's boyfriend is, if you didn't know.
Surprise!
It's Bill Clinton. Clive Owen's here. Also in prosthetics.
So we'll talk more about Clive Owen in future episodes. But, you know, he's got his one line. It's kind of like that Spencer trailer with Kristen Stewart, where she says one line. Everyone's like, oh, my God, she nailed it. But, like, Clive Owen really does nail that one line he has at the end of this episode.
It's true. I was worried. And it's a good line. But, yeah, thank you for bringing up that Spencer trailer example.
Because I'm never just, like, thinking about the Spencer trailer.
I'm like, they plucked the – I mean, hopefully her accent's flawless throughout, but I'm like, they definitely were like, that's her best line. Let's use that one. Yeah. Clive's here. Sounds like Bill.
Looks like Bill.
Is he as magnetic as Bill? Let's find out as the whole thing unrolls. But and once again, the whole question of Bill on the margin. Bill is so on the margin in this episode. You know, we get more Hillary than we get Bill, and we get barely any Hillary. And that ongoing question that I want to keep asking about, like, is centering the women in this narrative, does that have an unintended consequence of downplaying Bill's
bad behavior?
I don't know. We'll see. It's a question I have. I'm not sure how I feel about it, but I want to keep looking at it. Like, does this show do enough, to really give Bill his full level of responsibility in all of this?
Yeah.
I hope so. I think so. So that's it. Anything else you want to mention? Other than me almost forgetting that Bill Clinton's in this episode.
I wrote down, is it weird that this makes me want a baked potato? Because Linda goes home and microwaves her baked potato. And it's like,
oh, looks
it,
great.
It's, in one episode, she says it's like the happiest moment of her day. And I was like, man, I would eat a baked potato right now. No, I think this is such a great introduction to the show. Like, it's efficient. Like, this stuff is complicated. Whitewater is really complicated. Really? And the Vince Foster stuff is so, it's also convoluted. Like, to understand how Paula Jones, Monica Lewinsky, Ken Starr all got wrapped in together is really difficult. And I think this does a really good job setting all those pieces into motion.
I am really excited to hear our colleague Chris Murphy talk to Annalee Ashford about playing Paula Jones. So let's go ahead and listen to that.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Thank you so much for joining us, Annalee. I really appreciate it.
I'm so happy to be here.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. I got to say, impeachment, the first episode of impeachment really like blew my mind. It's really fantastic. And I've got to say, not to sort of out myself as a younger millennial, I did not know that much about Paula Jones sort of going into this process. So can you talk to me a little bit about like what you even remember from the Clinton affair and sort of what you knew before you went in and how familiar you were with Paula Jones?
Yes, that's a great question. I'm a little bit older than you, so I remember a little bit more.
No.
But I was a kid when it was happening, and I really remember this story and this moment in history from a late night news perspective and mm-hmm. also late night comedy perspective. First of all, why was everybody letting me stay up late? It was like I'd come home from dance and then just watch like late night talk shows. But part of where my sense of humor comes from. And I just remember these women being treated mercilessly about their looks and made fun of about their involvement in this story. So, you know, Monica Lewinsky was the first person really to be bullied on the internet. And I remember that. But also specifically Paula Jones was just constantly made fun of, poking fun at her being from the South and calling her trailer trash. And then people were just merciless about her looks and specifically about her nose.
Yeah.
So those are the things that I remember. And then I also remember that she was sort of the catalyst for all of the events that took place, but I wasn't quite as knowledgeable about how that happened. And I think this is just a really like shattering reminder that she was the first domino in the fall of sort of the Clinton empire of that moment.
Absolutely. And like, she's the first domino to fall, it sort of knocked down, you know, the whole thing. And I love what you said.
So she wasn't really interested in any of the political elements of this case at all. And in mm-hmm. the beginning, her objective for me as an actress, like what is this character's objective? And Paula Jones, her objective was to please her husband.
Yeah.
All it was about was pleasing her husband, making her husband happy. And the fact that it led to this really horrific public shaming for her and really unwanted role in the conservative machine mm-hmm. is sort of like shocking.
Absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head. It's really what she wants more than money or power, which is neither of those things, is an apology. And there's something so like beautiful about that, and a role for her husband in a film that was really great.
And really, she didn't even really want the apology. Really, it's her husband wanted the apology. So, and her husband wanted a role. So she really just was like, she wanted to make him happy. And mm-hmm. I think at the core of it, from what she wanted from Bill Clinton was admonishment that, you know, that she didn't do this thing that she was being accused of. It was so heartbreaking for her to be accused of doing a sexual act or a sexual favor that, mm-hmm. that she claims that she did not do. And I think that was, you know, I love that she says a lot, like, I need to clear my good name, you know?
Yeah. I really love what you said about the, you know, the 90s and late night television and how they sort of use these women as punching bags. I mean, it seems like we've got so far to go in that realm, even, you know, in 2021. But I, watching the show, seeing how, you know, how Monica and Linda and Paula all sort of, you know, deal with their aesthetic appearances, the Weight Watchers, the Slim Fast, the makeover that eventually happens for your character. Can you talk a little about how cognizant were you of that those beauty standards that were sort of really on display and so like terribly sort of imposed upon these women at that time?
I think that this show does a really great job of reminding of us of the influence of the patriarchy at that moment mm-hmm. in time. So that's one piece of it. And then the other piece of it is, I think at that moment in history, if you were pushed into the public eye, you were just fair game. Mm-hmm. To be made fun of, to be talked about. Well, it's your fault that you decided to be in the public eye. These women didn't ask really to be in the public eye. And so they were pushed into this sort of microscope and microcosm of the way that they looked and the way that they walked and the way that mm-hmm. they behaved and the circumstances that they were in. And so because of that, we felt that it was really important that we were pretty true to the way that Paula looked, because it was such a mm-hmm. source of her narrative and her story during this moment in history, to the point where she had more makeovers than anybody else on the show. I had more wigs than anybody else.
Wow. And those wigs were really wild. They were amazing.
They were amazing. And we replicated them to a T to what was happening in those. I mean, we would look at pictures and like just myopically try to match them because it was so important. And it was really important that I had a prosthetic nose, because that was a part of her stories that she, not only did she feel so bad about it, but also she was given this nose job for free. People paid for it, you know, she got braces. Mm. It's wild what she underwent in the public eye physically. And again, I really felt like it was, and the producers and Sarah Burgess, our brilliant writer, we all just felt like it was just too important to not show that part of her journey. It was like, you know, subtext for her whole character.
Absolutely. And as like an actress and a theater actress, so when you have, you know, those hours in the makeup chair, I'm sure it's like, you know, all the preparation for that was a lot. Does that help you sort of tap into the character more? Does it make you feel more encumbered? Was that, you know, the prosthetics and the wigs, and how does that sort of affect your process?
You know, every actor is different, but I always feel like that's the last piece of the puzzle. That's sort of the icing on the cake. And I, you know, looked back at people's experience working on Crime Story and the previous installments, and Courtney B. Vance So this amazing thing about playing Johnny Cochran. He was like, I was so nervous. He's so iconic. Also, Johnny Cochran, Linda Tripp, Paula Jones, you know, they had very specific ways of speaking. They had a very specific cadence. They had a very specific physicality. And so you don't want to do an impression of the person, but you do want to give their essence. So I, you know, tried to really pick and choose things about her physicality, things about her vocal timbre, and also dialect. And then I always felt like, you know, sometimes it'd be a while since I had gotten to be on set, you know, just the way that shooting worked out. It'd be a couple of weeks before and then I'd come back, and it was like I was putting on an old friend. You know, I'd check in with her and watch lots of clips and check in on my research. And she always just kind of felt natural to me. And that was just like such a blessing. And I also think a reflection of, you know, my homework that I did, but also really, really specific good wardrobe, really specific good hair and good makeup.
Wow. Okay. That's really fantastic. In terms of this preparation, how much, like where did you do this research? Were you online? Did you go to the newspapers? How did you sort of, you know, create this, not a caricature, but like walk this fine line between impersonation and also acting the person that is Paula Jones?
Yeah, sometimes when you play a real character, a real person, you know, you're always afraid of making them a caricature, because sometimes in real life, they feel a little bit larger than life.
Yeah.
You know, and she is one of those people. She's got a really, I think, sort of outgoing, kind of broad personality as it is. So you don't want to go too far, and you still want to make her human. So I watched a lot of footage. So thankfully there's tons of interview footage from her at all of these different points that we told the story. And then also I, you know, read as much as I possibly could get my hands on from the era. And thankfully she's done quite a few interviews about this time in history. So I had a lot to go off of. I used that. And then I also worked with a movement coach to make sure that I showed the progression of her comfortability in front of, reporters and talking in the press. And she gets more and more comfortable and confident as the years go by. And then also, just really making sure that I really had her dialect specific and correct, because it is a specific part of Arkansas. She speaks in a higher timbre, which is really common of women who are people pleasers, like myself. I'm a people pleaser. And making sure though that I could drop in when she dropped, you know, when she would have dropped in. You know, there are times in her journey where she eventually, you know, puts up a fight, and I wanted to make sure that she was grounded and could do that vocally. That was my journey in preparation.
Wow. That's really fantastic. I would love to talk about within the first episode, you mentioned these reporters, and there's a really heartbreaking scene. You know, Paula's first time at CPAC, you know, speaking to the press about what happened to her, where I think it's really beautifully executed, where basically a barrage of male reporters are basically treating her, you know, harassing her and, you know, verbally when she's talking about this sexual harassment that she received from Clinton. So can you talk to me about sort of filming that scene and how intentional it was that really it was all male reporters just sort of berating her and sort of how that day went on set and what you were sort of going through? Because it was emotionally heart-wrenching.
It's heartbreaking, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Ryan Murphy directed the first episode and the sixth episode, which is always exciting and magic. And he's just a genius person. So when the day started, he came in to check in and just sort of wanted to lay out how he wanted the scene to feel and how he was going to shoot it. And he really wanted the audience to understand how overwhelmed she felt and out of her element. And he really wanted to share with the audience that sense of patriarchy that evaded this moment. And the biggest thing that I think is important for people to know is that we didn't elaborate or accentuate that male dominance.
Mm-hmm.
It was all lifted from what happened for real that day. Almost every word is stuff that she really said for real. And some of the reporters said for real.
Wow.
And it was all men.
It was
a room full of men. There's footage. You can go watch footage of it. And there's some, that was always a really important scene to me for many reasons. Like if we didn't get that scene right, then you wouldn't feel for Paula. And I think it's important as an audience member who is reflecting on this moment and figuring out how we could have done better as a culture and society, you have to understand Paula's perspective and point of view. Mm-hmm. And so that scene was how we were going to accomplish that. And the other thing that's kind of crazy about the filming of that day is that costume, we had to replicate what she actually wore that day at CPAC because it's sort of famous. There's a lot of photos of it. You can watch it. And we actually found the real outfit on eBay because Paula Jones at some point in her life needed to auction it off for some reason. And somehow it ended up on eBay and I wore it in the show.
No, that's unbelievable.
Doesn't that blow your mind?
Yes.
And we all felt it. It was like the power of this like garment that I had on my body.
That
it
she wore
like, yeah.
At that time. Wow.
Yes. And we'd look back that day prepping my hair and makeup. We looked at a lot of archival footage of it and looked at a lot of pictures of it. And it was just like, it was a total mind fuck to like,
you can say mind fuck.
To like see her wearing what I was wearing in the makeup. Like, it was wild. We were all like, whoa, this is so meta.
Wow. That really plays into it, which is like is blowing my mind right now. A lot of these people, I mean, are still around. I mean, it's like the Clintons are still around. Paula is still around, you know. Ann Coulter, George Conway.
Brett Kavanaugh.
It's all of these sort of the Easter eggs of these people who are literally, you know, and have some of them have ascended to, you know, some of the highest spots of our nations or highest positions that our nation allows. What was the vibe like on set? Sort of, did you think about that a lot? Was that sort of like something that was sort of pervasive, or is it just like we have to shut that out and do the work that we are set out to do?
Well, there's two parts to that. The first part is this show is, like I always think, an act of social justice because it makes us reflect on what we could be better at as a culture and a society and how we did things wrong and how we can do things right now. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that this show does. It forces you also to see all points of view, which is a daring move from the producers. And I always think an important and brave one. Mm-hmm. It's something that sometimes we don't want to do. We want to make the easy choice and just show one point of view. So from that perspective, I just found it fascinating how this story that we're telling was the seed that was planted for the cultural and political conflict that we are experiencing now. It was the beginning of tribal mm-hmm. politics that we see now. It was the beginning of really, really polarized Republican Democrat party resistance and not working with each other and trying to get each other. I mean, it's always been there from the dawn of time, but mm-hmm. I think the impeachment of Bill Clinton is really a bunch of the seeds planted for what we see happening today.
Totally.
So that's the first part. And the second part is that, yes, we are playing people that are still really active in public life, but I think there was a part of all of us that was like, just move forward. We're telling the story from this time in history. And what did they want? What were they trying to get in this moment? You know, as actors, your first job is to figure out the objective of the character. And so we all just sort of focused on that. But it was also, this is the only installment of Crime Story where anybody involved in the story has been a part of telling the story. You know, there's usually so much research to draw upon. We don't need to go to the source.
Yeah.
But in this instance, Monica Lewinsky was a producer. She was really present. And thankfully a major part of retelling her piece of this story, which was a piece of it. There's, you know, this is just like a huge tapestry of so many threads. And
yeah.
Paula Jones was really like the thread that unraveled it all. And I think that's kind of going to be the thing that's most surprising to people when they revisit this story.
Yeah. Wow. I gotta say, that's really, yeah. You to keep your head down and do the work and not sort of, you know, you can't really worry about, you know, how the Clintons are going to.
A couple of weeks after I got the job, I literally went to an opening night of a beautiful play and they were sitting right behind me. And I was like, oh my gosh, it was such an interesting experience because I was like, I just got cast as Paula Jones. Yeah. You know, it was so wild to have them like sitting behind me.
Right there.
I wondered if they, you just sort of like, oh, whoa. That was sort of also a meta experience. But there's a lot of people that are it will be interesting to see how everybody sort of reacts to their involvement in our storytelling. But one thing I can say is Sarah Burgess did just an outrageously beautiful job of writing it and really showing all points of view. So I have to say is we went by the research and we went by all the volume of documentation about this era is like ad nauseum. There's so much source material to back up what was on the page and what you ended up seeing on screen.
Yeah. Wow. That's really wild. Yeah. Turn around, you get cast on this and you see them sitting right there. That's really fantastic. I will say something again, sort of with Monica getting to retell this story. I do think like it can't be said enough, having seen a bunch of these episodes and especially in the first episode, the emphasis on women and the female perspective, both Monica's and Linda Tripp's, I'd say the vast majority of the episode is centered around the women's voices in the story. Clinton doesn't even show up until the last millisecond of the first episode. As you said, Sarah Burgess did like a phenomenal job, you know, sort of writing and developing the teleplay and the script. How important was that specifically in the whole ecosystem of developing the show?
I think it was the driving theme of the show is to make sure that these women's voices and stories were heard and told. So you are dead right. The purpose of telling this story was to tell it from the women's perspective this time around. Brad Simpson always says this amazing thing that at the time it was the men's story. It was, you know, Bill Clinton versus Ken Starr and Newt mm-hmm. Gingrich, and it was all of these towering men, and the women's stories were never theirs. They were just a byproduct of what the media told you happened, and they were brutalized and made fun of for their looks and the way they talked and the way they behaved. And poor Monica Lewinsky, every private moment over a 2-year period that she had in her personal life was not only was it in a document that was used, you know, to impeach a president, but then they posted it on the internet, which I think is a really important thing for people to look at when they're looking at the impeachment that just happened. And if they're going to mm-hmm. compare it to that one, there was no release of the last report that just happened.
Totally.
The one that happened in the 90s was released and it reads like Fifty Shades of Grey. Yeah. You know, I think that's sort of like a just a wild moment of history that you're like, I can't believe that happened. And it happened in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, wow. It's wild. And it's just sort of like that was who was in control of that moment. And that's how they decided to handle it. And so I also find it interesting that I'm not being political. This is just like an observation. Mm-hmm. It's really fascinating that when you read the Ken Starr report, the way that it reads, the conservative men who put that together, it truly reads like a romance novel. It's quite shocking.
Yeah. Salacious. Yeah.
It's very salacious. So, and Monica could not speak during that time. She literally could not speak. That was part of her deal. Yeah. So I just think this is sort of not only is it retelling from these three women's point of view and perspective, but it's also like this really special opportunity for Monica to get the voice that she didn't have as a young woman then.
Absolutely. Wow. That's really, it's really powerful. And it's only just beginning. We're only one episode in.
Yeah. Get ready. It gets wild. It's so wild that you're like, I cannot believe this is real.
It feels like it's not real to me.
Yeah. If you wrote it, people will be like giving you all sorts of notes. That doesn't feel real. That's too weird. No, hat that's too crazy.
It's too
you got hat on a hat. You got to edit. But it was real.
It's really wild. Wow. I got to say, it's really phenomenal. And I know we only got a little bit of time left, but I just have to say, as a big fan of your theater work, which, you know, it's so funny and, you know, it skews comedic, it's, you know, and also, you know, deeply felt. Paula, also, you found moments of really hilarious humor within Paula as well as, you know, doing all this sort of important, you know, storytelling of sharing her voice and her side of it. But also there were actually some really sort of devastatingly funny moments. And sort of, did you think about that or just, you know?
You know, it's such a great question. Honestly, and unfortunately, the moments of comedy, all great moments of comedy come out of the highest stakes, the darkest moments. And for Paula, it truly was highest stakes, darkest moments. And they were so authentic. It's nothing that we decided to make funny or tried to make. Mm-hmm. We did not try to make anything funny at all. We were literally just telling her story.
Telling her story.
And
the drawing of the, you know. Of
larger than life. It literally happened. Everything, you know, I'd have to really take a breath and be like, you know, just sort of make sure that I wasn't playing into any of that because I knew it just was inherently funny, you know.
Yeah.
Just wild. It's crazy that happened, but it really happened. So we had to just tell the story.
Yeah.
And her sensibility is her sensibility and her energy is again sort of childlike, this sort of childlike quality that sometimes lends itself to like making you smile. I know what you're saying. It's wild.
It's a dichotomy because you see this woman who's like sort of so deeply, you feel bad for her. She's so deeply in over her head. And yet you like her relationship with her husband, her relationship with these lawyers, you know, these men who think they know what's best for her, or they don't even frankly care what's best for her. They're caring what's best for themselves. And I think that's
using her.
They're using her.
Used. Yeah.
Yeah. There's something really absolutely, tragically comic and heartbreaking about that, and that you like really tap into. And I gotta say, it's just really, it's having seen, I mean, you know, your work on stage, you know, Dot with, you know, I saw that Sunday
Thank
in the Park
you.
With George, another, you know, woman, another, actually not dissimilar from, another woman who's sort of trying to make her way, you know, and maybe not manipulated by a man, but sort of navigate that, her relationship with her, you know, her partner.
Yeah.
I can see there's these really phenomenal parallels. When do you think you'll ever get back on stage? Is that a crazy last
question? No, I can't wait. I'm so excited. I'm so grateful that all my friends in the theater community are finally getting to come back to work. And it's such a blessing. And I think we need to shout it to the rooftops how long they've been out of work because people sort of don't understand or realize.
Yeah.
But I can't wait to become an active I can't wait to join my friends in the theater community and become an active participant in bringing audiences back because we need it we need it as a human race. We need to be all together again, collectively sharing an artistic experience, and in the theater in a dark room is the most special way to do it.
The most special way. And until then, you got to watch Impeachment. I mean,
yes.
Like, yeah. Until we get it back, that's the, you know, that's definitely.
Amen. Tune in. It's good for your soul, your head, and your spirit.
Absolutely. It feels like a very unbelievably, like, deeply intense and absurd and just jaw-dropping play that actually did happen in real life, which is, you know.
I know you can't write this stuff. Oh, I'm getting a knock to come.
Can't make it up. All right. Well, thank you so much, Annalee, for taking time out of your schedule.
Thank you.
And it was so lovely talking to you. Really.
So good to talk to you, too.
So that's it for us for episode one of American Crime Story Impeachment. We're so glad you're here for this with us. We'll be back next week with more interviews, more discussion. And now that we know who all the players are, I think it's only going to be a little easier to follow everything along going from here. Richard should be back. Until then, Katie Rich, where can folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich and over on Little Gold Men, which I guess we mentioned at some point, but that's where I am too. You might know that.
You can find me on VanityFair.com. You follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can email all of us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. And you'll also find me, I don't know, probably snagging a box of M&Ms from the commissary for myself, not just for my boss.
So I will be happily eating my baked potato in my recliner.
Excellent. Until next week. Bye.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.